You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Precision Powerlifting Systems. I'm joined here by Dave Coughlin. So I'm going to have Dave introduce himself in a minute here, but I can't even remember the last interview I did. I think it was with Shane Hammond like months ago. I'm sick of having the same conversations with people. So I was like, there's nobody I really want to talk to, but I wanted to, and I had talked about changing the direction of the podcast a little bit and making it more like educational based and talking about the history and our programming a little bit more. And this just so happens to kind of just form itself. So Dave actually has a background in physics. And so since we use bands and chains a lot, I thought it'd be great to bring him on here so that we could actually break down the science of why you're just way fucking cooler if you put bands and chains on a barbell than everybody else on the planet. But I think Dave will bring a good viewpoint of the math behind why it's effective. And then hopefully I'll tie it together with some like understanding how plyometrics work within the physiology and the nervous system and stuff with the human body. And we can get a good understanding of accommodating resistance and training. But before we get into that, Dave, give a little background on yourself.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. So yeah, as I said, my name is Dave Coughlin. I am a longtime recreational lifter who studied physics in college and have always been fascinated by Lou Sims, may he rest in peace. The introduction of the band from the West Side. I remember watching West Side versus the World and was just sort of impressed by how scientific they were in their approach, despite the fact that, you know, to the untrained eye, they do kind of look like goons, right? So it was really interesting to hear about all that stuff. And so I think, Kev, you had been talking about, you know, accommodating resistance, and there was some discussions about, okay, why do bands matter? And, you know, I thought, you know what, why do they matter? And so I wanted to try to unpack some of the physics there for myself, because I know that they feel different than chains and machines and straight weight, but I couldn't quite figure out why. I knew there was something going on that was special, but I couldn't figure out why. And so this kind of prompted me, just, you know, you and I casually talking on Instagram, to blow some dust off my old textbooks, do a little bit of math, and I think we've got some pretty cool stuff on the physics of bands today.
I'm gonna let you just get right into kind of discussing those concepts and stuff, and then we'll tie it together at the end.
Sure. So The way to think about this most simply is you have the lifter, you have the bar, and the bar has weight. And weight applies force, like the bar applies force on the lifter. We lift the weight, that's basically, I lifted, 200 kilos, 400 kilos, whatever. Like, that's what you're doing, right? And this all happens in an environment with gravity, of course, and the gravity is constant, and the gravity is causing that bar accelerate at 9.8 meters per second squared. I forgot what the imperial units version of that is, but the point is the acceleration of that bar, which is where the force comes from, right? Force equals mass times acceleration, and we are exerting forces against that bar, comes from the mass is fixed, gravity is fixed. So the bar and the resistance it provides the weight is fixed. Everything is fixed. All right. So if you understand that, and everyone who's ever lifted weight understands that, right? Two plates, three plates, four plates, it gets heavier, but it's always the same heaviness. Biomechanics aside. So I'm going to put the biomechanics completely aside. That's you, Kev. You can talk about that. I'm talking purely about the physics here. Right. So if you understand that, so you have a barbell with weight, with gravity, trying to pull it down to the earth, to the earth, basically. Constant gravity, constant force. Now, what happens when you start adding bands and chains? This is where it starts to get really, really interesting. I'll start with the chain, because the chain is easy to understand. You attach chain to the bar weight system. Lifter, same lifter, puts the bar on their back. Let's say they're squatting. And they descend in the squat. And the chain starts to essentially be supported by the floor. For simple math, right, when the lifter is fully standing, fully erect in their squat, they are holding all 100 links. And then as they move to the bottom of the squat, the links start to be supported by the floor. Maybe at the bottom of the squat, they're supporting 60 links. Okay, so they got 60% of the chain. So again, simple math, you have 100 pounds worth of chain. You feel the full 100 when you're standing, and you feel about 60 pounds at the very bottom of the squat. And so as you move through the range of motion, you have progressively more and less, depending on the direction you're moving, weight, force being applied. Gravity is still constant here, still 9.8 meters per second squared. But every inch that you move, right, let's say that each link is 1 inch. Every inch that you move, you either have that the extra weight of one link added or the weight of one link reduced.
What would that actually be as force at that point?
Yep. So the force would be wherever you are in that squat, wherever you are in the squat. So let's just say you're fully erect. Okay. Legs are locked, whatever. You're feeling the full 100 pounds of the chain plus whatever's on the bar and the weights. So let's say you got two plates, 225, right? Standard 100 pounds worth of chain. So total system is 325. Okay. The lifter has 325 on their back. They're moving 325. Okay. Then they squat, they get to the halfway to the descent. And let's just say that, 20 of the links are now being supported by the floor, right? So now there's 80 pounds of chain on top of that 225 bar. So now it's a 305, right? That's the force being exerted by that system through the lifter towards the earth. At the very, very bottom of the squat, right? Let's say 60 links are still in the air. 40 links are being supported by the floor. Then they've got 60 pounds of chain on that 225 bar. They're looking at 285 at the very bottom. So then they reverse direction. They get halfway through. 285 becomes 305. And then they get fully erect. 305 becomes 325. So there is a dynamic, right? The accommodating resistance, right? And it gets heavier as they get stronger, generally speaking. But it's linear. And the acceleration due to gravity is constant.
Right.
So you have dynamic force, constant acceleration. And this is an important thing to remember, because with the bar, it was constant force, constant acceleration. With the chain system, it is dynamic force, constant acceleration. Let me pause there, make sure that everything's still tracking.
Yeah,
we're going to get to the weird stuff next.
No, that, and I think maybe I'll interject really quickly. So in terms of like when you're thinking of like biomechanics, so when we're going down, right, our muscles are getting that stretch. So the chain. So one of the things that we used to do for athletes is with plyometrics, we used to build this up. So we get to a phase in training where we probably have an eccentric loaded counter movement. So maybe they're holding 20 pound dumbbells. They do the counter movement with the dumbbells in their hands, drop the dumbbells, and then explode up. So when you're using an overload on the eccentric, even if it's straight weight, even if it's chained weight, so the speed of gravity is not changing like it would with bands, you're kind of getting that stretch with increased weight is going to give you a greater force coming out of the hole. So you're going to have greater acceleration and greater abilities to apply force. So like if you wanted to jump higher, squat the bar up with greater acceleration, it's going to kind of work on some of those qualities. And what it does, this is a poor way to explain it, but just to get a point across, it almost like bypasses our typical boundaries that we have within our nervous system, these safety boundaries. So like that Golgi tendon unit complex, right? So getting that overloaded fast stretch, it just has this expectation almost, right? And then when we drop the weight off of there and we accelerate up against it, we've kind of preloaded more weight than what's actually on that barbell, so we can get a stronger contraction. And that's kind of the idea behind chains, is it's preloading that eccentric, so it'll build up that concentric velocity and that ability to reach peak force faster. And because of the accommodating resistance, so it's called the peak contraction principle. So where you're at your lowest leveraged position, so where the hips are going to have the highest amount of struggle, that sticking point, that's where we're going to get our peak contraction. And then as leverages improve, we get deceleration. So acceleration actually goes in the opposite direction. So what the chains do, as long as you have the right amount of chain, that peak contraction has to be maintained longer because you don't get the increased leverage until probably almost 2/3 of the way up on the squat if you're using the right amount of chain. So you get to strain a little bit longer. So what it does is it kind of, it trains the body to reach peak forces faster because it knows it has to be fast in order to beat the chains. So over time of doing it, and this is a mechanism that we develop even when we're younger. So when we learn how to walk, like we get this like preloading, it's the idea of plyometrics. It's like preloading elastic rebound for each step that we take. So we kind of use these nervous system mechanisms to work in our favor to deliver higher performance. So this was the idea of plyometrics. And Louis actually took the idea of plyometrics and just applied it to a barbell. Does that make sense?
It does. So this is slightly off of the core topic, so we will definitely get to the bands. But the way that you're describing the chain makes me wonder if releasers would give you even greater, for lack of a better, like a greater effect in that same direction, because you'd have that sudden cessation or loss of that additional weight, right? So if you have releasers that at the bottom of the squat popped off, doing that like overloaded jump type thing that you said, like where you would do the counter movement, drop the dumbbells and then explode up, kind of picturing releasers being very much the same way. So what I'm curious from the biomechanical point of view, like chains versus release. I don't have releasers at home or in my home gym, so I've never been able to play with them, but it does motivate a certain thought.
But so that's the idea, right? So because you're releasing them, you're going to get that force. But the problem is that deceleration that occurs. So with a jump, there isn't acceleration, right? Because triple extension kind of just has this follow through, right? So if I hit the ground and I jump, I don't have to decelerate. Naturally, gravity is just going to slow me down at a certain height, and then I'm going to return back to Earth, right? But because of the contraction principle, just weight releases, you're going to have that same deceleration. Which doesn't mean that they're not applicable and they couldn't be utilized in a similar way as chains. You could use both, right? So maybe you want to overload the eccentric a little bit more and have some type of accommodating resistance on the concentric. So you could do weight releases plus chains. But I've only like messed around with them. I've never actually trained with them. So that there's a big difference there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, then let's get to the PC resistance, the bands, right? So the bands are interesting because of the spring-like mechanics that they introduce. And this is where, you know, if you've stood up, again, let's use that classic 225, right? Everyone loves that two-plate jingle, right? You got two plates, you put chains on it, it feels different. Of course it feels different. It's heavier, right? And it's dynamic, right? You squat down, you come back up, you go down, you come, and the weight's changing as you're moving. But if you just slap a couple of bands instead of chains, it feels different. Even if you swore up and down that it was 100 pounds of band tension, it feels different. And so the next part of this, you and my conversation here is going to be trying to explain why it feels different. All right. And if you take nothing else from this, think of it as super gravity. Okay. So for your listeners out there, we're going to turn up the gravity like we're doing some Dragon Ball Z training. It's awesome. So let's take a look at what's going on here. So first, and you can anyone listening can verify this on their own. If you go to Elite FTS, they have a chart that talks about band tension based on stretch. And that concept, you can put it in Excel spreadsheet, play with it yourself. But that is really what's at the heart of this, is the way that they vary their tension based on how far they're being stretched. All right. And this is the beginnings of thinking about these as springs, right? So a band doesn't look like a spring, but it behaves like a spring, right? So the more you stretch it, the more it fights back against you. And the closer it gets to being at rest, the less it's sort of pulling against you. So we know intuitively there's something going on here that's proportional to how it stretches. right? So there's a mathematical representation for that, right? Hooke's law. And essentially, the thing that we're very interested in is the potential energy of the spring, okay? And that is 1/2 kx squared. What the hell am I talking about? So 1/2, we know that means it's 1/2. K is the spring constant. K is essentially how much exertion that spring is going to do when you stretch it, when you deform it, right? So the band, when you stretch the band, A basically tells us how hard is it pulling back to its resting position. Okay, and then X, which is to the square, right? Very important because we're getting into nonlinear forces now, we're into quadratic. That's how far it's been deformed, right? So again, think of, so what does that tell us, right? So you have a spring or a band. Where you stretch it to the square of the stretch, so it adds up quick, it's going to have more and more energy stored in it. Now, why is potential energy important? Well, potential energy is what is happening or what is in play when you are lifting, right? So when you have the squat on your back, again, no bands, no bars. I said no bands, no chains. You're standing, let's say the lifter is 6 feet tall. That bar has a certain amount of potential energy at the top of their shoulders, right? And then as they squat closer to the ground, there's less potential energy. Now, the lifter is constantly controlling it, so it's not as exciting, right? But if you were to dump the bar from 6 feet, it would have a much higher velocity, not much, but it would have a higher velocity when it struck the ground than if a 5 foot lifter were to dump it, right? That extra foot of bar travel is space through which it can be accelerated. That's why the potential energy kind of matters here, because 1/2 kx squared, the band is building additional potential energy as you stretch to that fully erect squat position.
Supergravity.
And it's, yes, this is where the supergravity is going to come in. I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. But just the energy, period, is the more you stretch, the angrier the band gets, for lack of a better term. Now, here's what's interesting about the bands. I'm going to zoom in on that K for a second. I said it was a spring constant. The bands do not have a constant K. You look at, again, according to the chart that I used, which I borrowed from Mr. Tate, you look at the bands at 40, 50, 60, 70 inches of stretch, the K, which is pounds per inch, so the amount of force it's exerting back at you, proportional to the stretch, increases with stretch. So the amount of resistance from the band is proportional to how far you've stretched out the band. Now you can say, well, Dave, the resistance of the chain is proportional to how much chain you've extended off the ground. Correct. But this mechanism is interesting because it's going to affect the acceleration, which is where you get into supergravity. Let's just recap real quick, because we've already introduced like a lot of different random physics concepts, right? So you stretch the band wants to go back to where it was. The amount of energy stored in that band is 1/2 kx squared, the square of the distance. The potential energy of the chain is essentially going to be mass times distance times gravity. Right? So it's linear in proportion to the distance, not quadratic in proportion to the distance, which is important because it shows you that the rate of change is that much faster. Right? And again, you know, the taller the lift, or the more pronounced it would be, because they have a greater range of motion. Now, that's the potential energy. That's what's going on. And this K factor varies in proportion to the stretch. So you have this like extra dynamism that is applied to that lifter when they're lifting. It's very interesting. Now, what is happening the moment they change directions, right? So they're standing, they're fully erect. The bar is at maximum height. The band is at maximum tension. What is the acceleration caused by those bands? And this is where you get supergravity, right? Because remember, gravity is always accelerating at 9.8 meters per second squared. Constant. Doesn't matter what you're made of, what you're doing, 9.8 downwards. The band has acceleration, will accelerate that bar system down to the earth like a slingshot, like you're winding up a slingshot. It's K times X divided by the mass. Now, the mass doesn't really matter here, but that KX factor. Now, we know that the K is going to increase as you stretch it, and X increases as you become more erect. As you stand up, you stretch the band. And so what happens is you have this extra acceleration, depending on how much band tension you load up with, which is definitely going to be stronger than Earth's gravitational pull. And so this hyper acceleration, this super gravity, is what's causing that sort of special characteristic of the band. Now, I don't understand how that translates into the biomechanics, but this extra, like that slingshot effect, is creating an acceleration that you cannot get from bands, doesn't matter how, from chains, doesn't matter how heavy the chains are, or straight weight, because you're always working with that acceleration of 9.8 meters per second squared. The bands are doing something different. They're adding this extra acceleration that the body has to accommodate for somehow, because otherwise you would be thrown off of your squat. So that's the kind of interesting part about the, and I'll talk a little bit about the proportions here, but if you understand that the potential energy from that band being stretched is 1/2 kx squared, right? So it's the square of the stretch. So that, the longer you stretch it, the more it's going to fight back. So the more energy you'll have, much more than a chain being moved linear with linear potential energy. The K in these bands is dynamic. So as you stretch it, the gravity of the band increases, right? And then finally, the acceleration is the product of K and the distance stretched. But you know that K is also a function of the stretch. Therefore, you have this nonlinear, looks like it's quadratic acceleration, which gives you that super gravity, right? It's attempting to throw you down towards Earth as more so than the weight would on its own. So, Calvin, I'm going to kick it over to you to see what kind of like biomechanical things you want to call out. But that's the really fascinating thing about the physics here, is that Hooke's law and how the band imitates the spring.
So one question first. So we know we have to keep tension on the bands in the hole of the squat. So if the bands lose the tension in the hole, right? So say you don't put them on high enough, you go down and then they just get loose. They go back to their original shape. Is that potential energy lost?
Well, it would be lost, but you still have, it would have fully dissipated. So let me think about two scenarios, right? So one scenario is you have them fairly tight. So even at the very bottom of the squat, the lowest part of the range of motion, there is still band tension. You can pluck it like a string on a guitar and it'll go thong or something like that, right? Then you've got another scenario where at the very, very bottom of the squat, the band is essentially released. There's no tension in it. It's floppy. Okay. Mm-hmm. As you go back up to fully erect, the band will catch and you will start to get that tension. So in the floppy one, and if it's tight the whole time, it's tight the whole time. So you'd have a much greater tension at the top if it's choked tight throughout the entire ROM, a range of motion. But even if it's floppy at the bottom, by the time you start to get that band tension will give you the super gravity. You're just going to get a lot less of it.
I see. Okay. And at what point does, because you were talking about, when we were messaging, there was like a 3% difference or something like that in order to feel it. So if you're getting a lot less.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. So that that's the final point, I guess, for the way the spring works. So if you, there's a principle that was like casually shared with me, and because I don't know if this is like biomechanically valid, but the way I explained it was your body will not really notice a change in force unless it's at least 1% different. So if I gave you, and the way they explained it was, if I gave you, you know, 10 reams of printer paper, you hold them with your arms, the elbows at 90 degrees, right? Okay, 10 reams of printer paper. If I put, you know, 5 extra sheets on top of it, you won't notice, right? But if I drop a ream on top of it, you're going to feel that. You will notice the difference, right? Because it's a greater than 1% difference. So the reason I brought that up when we were talking was, if you look at the difference in the K, which drives the difference in acceleration and manually, for a 10-inch stretch, it was about 3%.
Okay.
Right? And that level of dynamism in the K creates that level of dynamism in the acceleration. And if the mass is essentially constant, like the bar, 225, the band is basically zero mass compared to the bar, right? So all of the sensation is really driven by that different acceleration and K. So if you're moving through a 10-inch squat, right, and you've got your tension at the bottom and at the top, although it doesn't, that's less important. What's important is that you have that 10-inch range of motion, 10 inches worth of travel, you have a 3% increase in what the band is doing to you, essentially. And so that's absolutely going to go exceed that 1% noticeable threshold. Depending on how your chain is set up, you might even, like at the very top and the very bottom, it's obviously going to be very noticeable, but like inch by inch, you might not even notice that it's getting heavier until you kind of get to the end. You're getting stronger as you open your knees anyway, but it's an interesting dynamic where the band is that 3% difference as it sort of gets stretched, and all of the consequences of that, the acceleration is 3% greater, which is just interesting to think about the physics of that, because the force is driven by the acceleration for a constant mass. Anyway, that's where the 3% thing came in. 10 inches of travel will increase what the band is doing to you by 3%. Roughly speaking, yeah.
First time I ever did bands, right? So I've done like chain work. And what did I use? Maybe I doubled up minis or something on a squat. I'm 6 feet tall, so I have a decent range of motion on my squat. I feel it pulling me down. I'm kind of using the speed. I hit the hole hard. I get, I don't know, a third of the way up on the squat, I felt like I hit a fucking wall. Like it just, yep. I hit it and all my air went out, right? So it's where my body was just used to decelerating, right? So I'm just sharing an experience because I think everybody who's used bands can identify with this, just how different it feels, right? So like normally where I'm so used to using straight weight all the time, my body's used to decelerating there. And when the bands kicked on, it almost just became this like defense mechanism reaction piece. It just like, I was like, holy crap. This is different. And what's interesting enough is like when you use a certain amount of band tension constantly, it gets easier. And then that's when you have to adjust it, right? Depending on what you want to train. So in terms of like the biomechanics of it, so this is where the shock method comes in. So Yuri Verkhoshansky's widely renowned kind of as the like grandfather of plyometrics. So he actually developed this in the late 1950s. So just a background on him, he obviously wrote Super Training with Mel Siff. And of course, Louis did the Super Training tour with Mel Siff. So a lot of this information he was privy to. And also, I think he had a relationship with Verkhoshansky. So it probably doesn't help. I mean, it probably doesn't hurt having the grandfather of plyometrics come in and help you create some of these things. So like what you were saying, like you look at them and it's like, oh, they look like a bunch of goons, but they had a strong enough passion and surrounded themselves with really smart people and just learned from them. And it just, you know, it just goes to show, it's incredible. But so Verkhoshansky was a track coach and a researcher in Russia at the Aeronautical Engineering Institute. he had 12 athletes that ended up becoming masters of sport, where in Russia they have a classification system. We actually use it here too. It's just not as, like, people just don't understand. It's usually how they determine who qualifies for nationals and stuff. But it goes class 3, class 2, class 1, candidate for master of sport, master of sport, master of sport in international competition. So a master of sport is basically somebody who's of Olympic caliber. They're strong nationally and could qualify for the Olympics. So it's a big deal for an Olympic sport, and powerlifting is a little bit different. So he eventually became a national team coach, and then ended up developing his research even further. So the shock method came about based off of collisions, right? So a collision is going to conserve momentum. And this is where kinetic energy comes in biomechanics. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to actually use Verkhoshansky's words here for the definition of the shock method. And it's, the essential element is sharp compulsory muscular tension initiated by the body's impact. So that impact, that's the collision with an external object. So a collision, it's an isolated event where you get two or more moving bodies that exert force on one another for a relatively short time. But this can also be one body that's moving and one that's not. So when we sprint, our foot's hitting the ground, our foot's moving, the ground's not, but there's a collision. And within that collision, there's a nervous system response that comes from it. It's kind of a learned response. You learn it, you start walking, and then obviously you can skip later, you can sprint, and you can do some incredible athletic movements. But it's our nervous system and our soft tissue system kind of recalibrating and progressing over time. So we actually ran a bunch of experiments starting in the 60s, where we compared like no counter movement jumps to counter movement jumps, and then the depth jump. So a depth jump is where you stand on a box, you step down, you hit the ground, and then you try to jump as high as possible. So depth jumps are actually like a very commonly used plyometric exercise. And this was actually the exercise he used in the research to show the shock method. And then he did in the upper body. So there was a force plate. So you lay down on the ground, there was a force plate that you could put your hands on. So it was the same thing, no counter movement, counter movement. And then it was basically dropped on them, and they kind of almost like a ballistic bench would be, they kind of like went with it and then exploded upwards. So they could do it that way. And then the third experiment, he actually used 12 highly trained volleyball players for 12 weeks. They trained 3 times a week, and depth jumps were used in the first 4 weeks, and explosive strength increased by 26% and max strength increased by 14%. So when people are like, oh, dynamic effort doesn't work, dynamic effort doesn't work, like, I think one, like, people need to understand that, like, buy-in number one is really important. If you don't understand the concepts in which you're applying, it's going to be really hard to have that buy-in and understand how it works. I think the other part of it too is like, when people put bands on a bar, half the time they don't do it right, and the bands jumping off at the bottom. And then the other part is they don't know how much tension to actually use. It's either too much or too little. And it does really matter, because when it's too light, it doesn't even feel like it's there. When it's too heavy, it hits you like a ton of bricks. And it's all about acceleration. Yep. Like, strength is measured in speed. So when you think of a max effort squat, probably moves in like 4/10, 5/10 of a second. But like, when we're trying to train some of these explosive movements, we're looking at like 1.0 to 1.3 meters per second that we're looking for acceleration. So if you're not within those ranges and you're always training at a slower speed, you will get slower. And so Tudor Bompa was kind of like the grandfather of periodization, and talked about like absolute strength is the building block of all other strengths, right? And you get Hill's law that shows the same thing, where yes, if you increase strength, your explosiveness will go up, but there's a point where that doesn't work anymore. So like, an example I like to use, like, if I take LeBron James and make him stronger, is he jumping higher? And you wouldn't look at him like he's weak, right? He's been bodying people up in the NBA since he's been 18 years old, right? So right. Like, at some point you do need to get specific. So when everybody wants to throw the said principle, bands aren't specific. Well, it is specific to building certain strength qualities that you can't train with straight weight, right? So like, varying training is important. And varying the force and how the time in which you're applying force is really important. So like, straight weight, you're only going to be applying force, the peak contraction principle, right? So acceleration stops there, right? You get your peak contraction, then deceleration occurs. With bands and chains, you can increase the acceleration. It probably doesn't go all the way up unless you're using really heavy accommodating resistance. But now maybe instead of it being, I'm making these numbers completely up, like I'm pulling them out of the air, so don't take them for what they're worth. But maybe it goes from being half a second to a full second that you're swinging, right? Like, it's making even 0.7, 0.8, like, that's more than it was before. And you can bypass some of these typical boundaries that we have if we're only using straight weight. Mm-hmm. So eventually Verkashansky, he ended up quitting his coaching job, doing more researching stuff. And wrote a lot of books on this stuff. But so getting back to like the kinetic energy and how it works with plyometrics, right? I'm going to quote him because I think this quote really, you know, he clearly knows what he's talking about. So I'm not going to try to take his words and make them my own. But so here it is. So when free weights are employed, the magnitude of the muscle's working tension is a function primarily of volitional effort. However, in the shock method, the activation of the working muscles is forced. The, you know, forced is in quotations here. The external factor of the weight example only assists the force produced by the muscles. On the other hand, with the shock regime, the external factor, so the external factor being kinetic energy, forces the body to mobilize the innate motor resources. So basically what he's saying there is it forces the CNS and the physiological systems to exceed ordinary boundaries. So if you, and you, the more you train this, the more efficient you become at doing it. So basically you recruit more motor units, you recruit more motor units faster. And when you do those two things, you become stronger. So I think, you know, a lot of times there's this psychological block. Oh, the weights are lighter, so it's not going to help me lift heavier weights. But yes, by themselves, you can't just do like West Side's dynamic effort day and expect to increase your absolute strength. It's too fast, right? So when you look at somebody like LeBron James, so a takeoff in sports like sprinting or jumping or something like that happens in a very short period of time, right? So there's a strength deficit that occurs. And in a takeoff, the estimated strength deficit is approximately 50%. So you're actually only using about 50% of your max, which this may be why like power training is somewhere within that realm of 50%, right? Because it has to happen in a smaller amount of time. Remember, strength is always measured in time. So LeBron James might be able to body me up on a basketball court because he's winning that first step every single time. He's faster and he's more explosive, right? So he gets better leverage. And with that better leverage is better strength, but he's probably not out squatting me, right? So even though he'd be stronger on the court, he's got that strength deficit that when we actually have to slow him down and you'd have to strain through a rep, it would be very different. So not that I don't think it's important to train absolute strength in that population, the athletic population, it absolutely is. Pun intended, but at some point you can't just keep increasing your absolute strength because it's too slow. So you have to somehow find a way to recruit more motor units. So again, I'm pulling these numbers out of a hat based off of memory, but I think the average person only recruits about 60% of their muscle fibers. So like the amount of motor units actually being eliciting a response. I think a highly trained weightlifter elicits a response from 80%. So there's a big 20% difference, but then there's also a 20% amount that's just, it's a defense mechanism. You don't want to just kind of blow all your energy at once because then you're dead in the water if you have to do something else. So what we're trying to do is bypass defense mechanisms progressively over time. So it takes, you know, building up, making sure you're putting the right weight on the bar, moving at the right speeds. And like, if you're a newer lifter and you're fighting the bands on the way down, that's not the point. So I remember Louis talking about when they, I think it was Ohio State, some of the exercise physiology, either researchers or students, I forget who had come there, but they used 550 pounds of straight weight and measured the eccentric and it was 1.6 seconds. And then they placed a lot of bands on there. I think it almost totaled 700 at the top. And it might've been like 400 straight weight, the rest in bands. I forget exactly what it was, but the eccentric had cut down to half a second. So it was three times faster on the way down. So they weren't fighting the bands. They were letting the bands pull them down faster. So kind of using that super gravity that you were talking about to use that stretch reflex, right? The faster it stretches, the greater the, it's going to return to its natural state. So even if we take the band, if we stretch it really fast and let it go, it's going to actually have, it'll go a further distance than it would if we slowly move it. Like if you take a rubber band, right, and you're trying to shoot it off your fingers, if you pull it back and let it go fast, it's going to go further than if you do it really slow. And so your muscles kind of work in a similar manner where we want that fast stretch. And then on top of that, because your nervous system has to respond, you can kind of start to increase your ordinary boundaries so that you become a more explosive athlete. And you do the variation of force. So you might be able to use straight weight for a period of time. And depending on everybody's, you know, genetic ceiling, their background, whether they gain weight, whether they decide to take drugs. So if you take a lifter and they just start lifting and they're just doing comp lifts and they start to get stuck and they gain weight, their increase in mass is going to let them put more weight on the bar, right? Then they might hit a spot and they want to get on drugs. The drugs are going to allow them to do more volume. So they're able to do more work, increase their work capacity, their recovery a little bit, so they can increase their numbers. But at some point, if you're not addressing the other strength qualities, you're just going to get slower and slower and slower. And at some point, once you slow down too much, you're done, right? Because strength is measured.
Right.
So at some point you have to speed it up to then slow it back down in order to develop some of those other abilities so you can free up more motor units to actually do it. And when, you know, people on the internet always want to talk about efficiency, and there's a time and a place where you want to be more efficient, but the more efficient you are, the less force you're actually producing. So if you're far out from a meet, you probably want to be generating more force. So like variations putting you in less efficient positions are going to let you generate more force, when force production should be kind of like the specific work you're looking for at those times. And then obviously as a meet gets closer, start getting more efficient. And what we'll do in our programs actually is we'll start the, like where Westside would do their dynamic effort work, we do a little bit more higher frequency stuff, but we might have comp lifts at 70% for like 8 triples or something like that. And we'll start that, you know, let's say 8 weeks out. And as they get more efficient with those, I can bring in more max effort work because they're not using as much energy at the bottom. So the recovery for them becomes easier. And then we can get more of that like specific max effort work. So it allows them to maintain volumes while pushing intensities at the same time. And then we do a hard taper towards the end. But there needs to be a time and a place where like developing force is the primary goal. And those bands and chains are a way to do that, and they're a way to vary it, and they're different from one another. And that doesn't mean bands are better than chains. They're just different and they serve different purposes. And they should all be utilized. Like bands are harder to recover from because of the overspeed, the super gravity, that high speed eccentric, that's really hard to recover from. The eccentrics is what really beats you up. So
closer to that's where the damage comes from. Yeah,
exactly. So like when we're 6 weeks out from a meet, it's all chains. I get rid of bands completely. Just because it's harder to recover from, and recovery becomes a main goal at those periods of time. So using both, messing with bar weight, messing with band tension, chain weight, using both, like it gives you a lot of options. I just rambled and I don't know if any of that made sense.
No, it did. It did. Tons of it made sense. And the eccentric study that you referenced, where they basically cut their eccentric in half, and then that goes right back to, you know, when Louis was talking about overloading the eccentric. And then if you think about from a bodybuilding point of view, right, going to a different weightlifting modality, but like, you know, create people like Dorian Yates were using forced eccentrics in order to get maximum damage done. So that all just reinforces what you're talking about, which is, you know, pulling them out as you get closer to the meet, not even from like a specificity point of view, but just from like a, we don't want to beat these guys up too much point of view, which makes perfect sense.
There may be a piece to it too, right? Like eccentrics.
Sorry, was that last question?
So because eccentrics build muscle, you might actually put on more muscle mass using bands in a certain phase of training too. The Dorian.
Possibly. Yeah.
What do you think of that? Yeah.
Yeah, if you're, you know, if you're doing like a mass phase with your periodization, I mean, I think approach to using them to overload the eccentric might be different. Like you meant, you know, the study showed that they cut it in half, so they're basically trying to hit the hole as hard as they can. Right. I think if you wanted to turn the band resistance into something with a greater hypertrophy benefit, you're probably going to fight the band all the way down, which is maybe not ideal from the force production point of view, but definitely would give you some extra tools if you wanted to maybe bulk up a little bit of the leg muscles. Or the, you know.
So one of the things that I tend to do if I have bands on for squats, and maybe this is where it becomes like really beneficial, I'm doing good mornings or something after, I just leave the bands on. So maybe using bands on some of those like supplementary exercises, like, and I'm not hitting the hole hard with the good mornings. I'm going in a much more,
not if you want to live, yeah.
Like a much more deliberate pace. So maybe it has like,
right,
some added benefits in terms of hypertrophy in those exercises or whatever.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to take a, I don't know, it'd be probably difficult to measure hypertrophy because it's happening at such a small scale, but if there was a way to calipers or something, see what the spinal erectors are doing, if you are doing like a block with the overloaded negative on your good mornings,
Yeah, right.
You can do your own study. Yeah, see what happens. But yeah, it's an interesting idea.
Did we miss anything?
Not really. I mean, the main, just to recap, right? So you have the acceleration due to gravity is omnipresent no matter what modality you're training. You have the bar weight system, which will always exert constant force. From a physics point of view, again, biomechanics are completely removed from anything I say. The chain system, so bar weight chain system, acceleration is the same. The force is dynamic. The force is dynamic in a linear proportion to the movement, the range of motion, right? Every inch you move picks up or puts down one extra link of chain. And then with the band, you have this very interesting, you know, spring tension effect where the acceleration is dynamic and the force is dynamic. So that's where you get this super gravity. This is where you get that overloaded eccentric. This is where you get that extra kind of oomph that just makes the band feel different and it gives you some additional options for your training toolkit. So those are, and you know, just as a closing thought, so the band and the chain does let you, air quotes, overload the movement, right? So your 225 becomes 325, but that quadratic dynamism from the bands, it's really doing something special. And I think that really just, you know, I think the timing of this discussion is fairly interesting given what happened with Lou, but you know, it shows you how ahead of the curve he was. I think he was leveraging it without fully understanding it and had great results.
Absolutely. And I think you make a good point there, right? Like, I think there's huge misconceptions within this. This is why I wanted to do this anyways. Everybody's like, there's no need to overload the top in a raw lift. And it's like, man, when I'm programming chains and bands, I'm never thinking about overloading the top. That's never even a thought. That, and I don't give a shit about overloading the top. It's right, more about force production at the points of, you know, the collision with the, you know, you have the bar moving down, your feet on the ground and reversing direction. It's more about the force production of the lift itself. I never even, the only time I think of like overloading the top basically is just increasing peak contraction time. That's all I'm looking for. But even then, it probably only goes 2/3 of the way up with the amount of bands and chains. Right. In the range of motion. So I don't care about, it's not about overloading the top. It's about the other things that we discussed in the podcast here.
Right on, man.
Yeah. So if you guys want to follow me, it's KW Can. It's my personal account. Do or don't, I don't care. Precision Powerlifting Systems on Instagram. I'm going to sign off here. So stay strong, Boston.
All right, Chief. Thanks, man.